Gentlemen, for another edition of Comics and Pop Tarts. My name is Michael, your host, Inevitable Mike, and today we have some awesome guests with an awesome project that just came across inkpup.com's guests. And I'm so excited to bring you today Michael Tanner, the author of Battle Grapple Rebel, and I don't want to mispronounce the name of the artist.
That's Don Wen, but he can tell you if it's wrong or not.
There we go. And Mr. What's Don Wen.
Hello, Wen. Yes, Wen is in winning it.
And Wen is in winning Battle Grapple, man. Congratulations for successfully funding on Kickstarter.
Thank you.
That's just the first step of the journey.
Yep. And the second step is usually like rewards. I haven't seen any releases for that. You guys got any knockdown rewards for what's coming next?
Well, the big push is the Get Some Color initiative, which is if we get to 100 backers, the book's going to be coming out in color. It's a black and white book because color is expensive. But if we get to 100 backers, it's going to be a full color book.
Yeah, we're only 27 people away, so we just need 27 more people to jump on board. And we do have a variant cover by Brett Waldelli, which is really cool. He's awesome. Did Southland Tales.
Absolutely awesome, man. Now, Battle Grapple, for people who don't know, is a pro wrestling comic. Normally, we don't see a whole lot of pro wrestling stories because it's a sport. For most people who consider it a sport, but it tells stories. It's full of drama. It's full of crazy characters. This one, though, I find specifically more interesting because it's not just a story. It's also a science fiction story, because this is basically, as I think I've seen it put, as pro wrestling in space.
Yeah, like you said, pro wrestling is a very unique art form. Because it's like for some reason, even though for the better part of like a quarter century now, it's openly like not a legitimate competition. they are athletes, but right. it is a scripted form of art. But for some reason, we still think of it in terms of sports. Like it's covered by the sports page for no apparent reason. Like it doesn't make sense. But people like we as a culture have never let go of it's a sport because we have to kind of then address like the athletics of it. And and it's real crazy. And so we decided, so coming up with the central premise was what would pro wrestling be like in the future, or what would pro wrestling be like in the Star Wars universe, and kind of going from there.
The Star Wars universe. I don't know. In that sense, I'd have to say, I don't know. Cause you have the Force powers. So that would kind of be unfair as far as like, the Greco-Roman style.
Yeah, but I feel like if the Jedi aren't allowed to marry or have families, they're probably not allowed to become pro wrestlers.
I always disagreed with that aspect, and that's why I thought Darth Vader always did so well. But yeah, you're right. Pro wrestling's been a thing since, I mean, the Greco-Roman period, hence the name Greco-Roman wrestling. We've always liked the arena style fighting, regardless of how athletic it was, with like the Romans, the gladiators, way back in the Roman times. Mm-hmm. And wrestling has kind of like perfected that into a performance art of sorts.
And, they made a story.
I love how you say it's art, because it's exactly what it is. It's a performing art.
Yeah, pro wrestling is closer to classical ballet than it is to, you know, the Olympic Greco-Roman wrestling. Like, they are athletes. They put their bodies through hell to tell a story for the audience. That's a ballerina and that's a pro wrestler in the same description. And you wouldn't see Swan Lake covered by the sports page, so it doesn't like the trappings of sports still hang on it, but it's very different. So yeah, so this book, and whenever you see pro wrestling depicted, it is like gladiatorial. Unless you're telling a wrestling story in contemporary, you know, America or the contemporary Earth in 2022, or at any point once it was acknowledged as being predetermined, like everything you put pro wrestling in any other context, it's always they're actually trying to kill each other. And that's not Battle Grapple. Battle Grapple is pro wrestling. These are performers. They go into a match and they understand who's going to win and who's going to lose and what right. story they're telling. It just happens to be on a different planet than what we've seen before.
Well, that opens the doorways for so many things. And does are there going to be aliens in the book?
The way
or robots? I mean this.
There, no spoilers because this is only issue one, but there are aliens. The way I decided to tackle aliens in this universe is the same way in contemporary pro wrestling, the way ethnic was quote unquote ethnic wrestlers were treated mm-hmm. as kind of special attractions. So you'd have like the baseline in Battle Grapple they're all kind of humans. But you have a few token aliens that are there as representing their planet. And that can be like really uncomfortable and problematic. And that eventually that will become part of the storyline is how people develop their views of, you know, well, it's aliens or other cultures based on the popular culture that they consume. And pro wrestling is popular culture. So you get like, a guy who's never met someone from, you know, Centauri 5. All he knows is, well, the Centauri 5 wrestler is a dastardly heel and he's a cheater and you can't trust him because that's what he's learned from television. But really, the people on Centauri 5, they're just regular folks. They maybe have antennas or like two extra arms, but they're just regular people.
It opens up the question, though, for what we would call special rules for wrestlers would be natural to them because they have the extra appendage or an extra antenna. So what would pro wrestling be like against like an alien or like a sentient robot? Like that opens the floodgates open for so much more to play around with in the future.
Yeah. Cause you could, there's pro wrestling tropes involved with ethnicity. Like Samoans all have, really hard skulls. So a Samoan headbutt is worse than a regular non-Samoan headbutt. So it's like weird racist stuff in pro wrestling that has existed. And that's going to be addressed in the future context of Battle Grapple, wrestling in space.
Man, if we're being honest, pro wrestling has succeeded on just about every topic you could ever think of, political or not. So they take everything, whether it's controversial or non-controversial, important or non-important, and they turn it into a story. Yeah. Like I've been watching pro wrestling for 25 years. I even wanted to be a pro wrestler at a small point in my life. I went to go do it here in South Mississippi. I went to a training school called SWA Warzone. Just getting into the business, learning how to headlock and, I was with my ex-wife at the time. She gave me an ultimatum. Of course, I was a family guy, so I chose family over wrestling. But I got a good bit of taste for it before I decided to go on like the career path I am now. But I never lost the love for the characters or the controversy or the drama, breaking things like kayfabe and how that's been like a huge thing in pro wrestling business. How it used to be such a secret to the business to never break kayfabe. And then slowly over time, kayfabe became a thing of the past because it was really hard to keep your persona in the eyes of the public, especially outside of the ring. And now that we have so much technology like social media and stuff, it's hard to be the bad guy on Saturdays and convince everybody, you know, in your real life that you're just a normal dude.
Yeah, that's wild when you hear like stories. Like, I love listening to like Jim Cornette tell stories about like the territory days, and he'll talk about like kayfabe and like how the heels couldn't travel with the baby faces. And there's a great story of, I forget which wrestlers it was, but it was like a babyface was having like a barbecue that he thought was that just for like other guys in the business he knew. And yeah. So there's like, you know, the guy he was feuding with was invited. And so they were like, it was just like friends all in the know having a barbecue. And then like the guy's in-laws just like popped by for a visit, and they weren't smart to the business. So he had to like, they had to pretend that the heel had come over to start some shit. And they had to like fake an argument in front of the in-laws. And like the guy had to leave the party under the auspice of like, yeah, he just showed up to ruin our family barbecue. But all right, sorry, man. I'll see you next week. But it's funny because Don didn't grow up as like a big wrestling head. Like, you know, Don, you know, like the basic, like popular wrestlers, but you weren't like a diehard, were you?
No, I wasn't diehard. So I grew up, you know, like 80s, 90s. Obviously, as an 80s, 90s kid. So my wrestling really was like, you know, running with the Hulk, WWE, some WCW stuff, you know, into some of the guys that were like very prevalent, like Stone Cold or The Rock through the 90s into the early aughts. And then I have been caught up.
What you think?
Yeah. So I have been caught up into there. But, you know, I did grow up not realizing that wrestling was choreographed. So, you know, I grew up thinking like, oh, these guys are really going at it. And, you know, it's totally legit. And then it wasn't probably until like, you know, later 80s, like early 90s. It's like, no, this is choreographed. But I still loved it. I still loved watching it because, you know, it's just like you said, it really is a ballet meets essentially a soap opera.
Yeah.
You know, it has that melodrama. It has the athleticism. It really is like, you know, almost a soap opera geared towards just people who love testosterone, whether you know, you'd be a boy or a girl or whatever. So yeah, that I, you know, like I don't know like anything beyond like the 80s into like the 70s. So I'm out of touch in terms of that point, but you know, I do enjoy it. I just, especially recently, haven't had time to delve into it. But, you know, when we were working on this book, I did go into deep dives and was just watching tons of clip videos. It was like, oh, 2 hours later, I just watched a ton of Stone Cold videos or like a ton of Bret Hart videos. It's like, oh. So that would be my role and depth and interest in wrestling.
A friend of mine once put it a really good way where he's like, professional wrestling is the only TV show where violence never solves problems because things are never resolved. Yeah. The guys just move on. Like, all right, you beat me. I'm just moving on to fight a different person. The violence never solved an issue.
Well, yeah, because it can't, because that would defeat the whole purpose.
You gotta keep going.
It's always like, especially when they lose the title. Oh, it's like, I lost the title now. Where's my rematch? They get the rematch and they get their ass whooped again. And it's like, that person I've never fought before, we need to have a feud. Come over here. Like, yep.
I need something to do to justify my money.
Yeah, it's wild, man. I can't imagine growing up watching wrestling for as many years, even a whole year, without noticing some of like, the shoulder taps and like the leaning in. Like when I was watching wrestling growing up around the same time in like the 90s, is before WWF became WWE after the lawsuit and stuff. Mm-hmm. You could, like, there was something funny to me about some of the pauses in between the matches, how like they would pick each other up, or when someone would go flying at somebody in the corner, they would just kind of like lean in. I was like, what is he whispering in his ear? Like, what the hell are they saying to each other?
See, my headcanon for how it worked was, as a kid, I believed that WWF was fake and WCW or NWA at the time was real. And that explained how like wrestlers would go from company to company. in my head, it was like, oh, if they got injured doing the real stuff in NWA, they'd go to WWF and heal up because it was fake. Right. And but also in that, it was you'd see, although they were actually physically competing, it wasn't they were actually trying to kill each other. They were trying to beat each other. So that's where you would see, like, the guy would not punch the guy fully because that's against the rules. Right. And the other guy knew how to take the punch. So that's how you would see, like, how I reconciled the cooperation that's involved in pro wrestling is they're trying to beat each other, not beat each other in terms of the match, not beat each other to an inch of their lives and kill the other guy. So it was like, you know how to drop someone where it's going to hurt, but it's not going to kill them. And they know how to fall and take the suplex without getting killed. So that was how it worked in my head.
Yeah, to take a suplex and all those other moves, you gotta tuck your head into your mm-hmm. chest to make sure they don't hit the mat at the same time to avoid a neck injury.
Yeah.
Some of the training that I learned when I was trying to become a pro wrestler.
Like this book kind of grew out of me sitting down to lunch with a friend of mine who also trained to be a pro wrestler. And he did it. I think he had a few matches like in training school, but he took a move and like knocked out his front teeth. And that made him be like, no, this isn't for me. Yeah. And then, now he's a voiceover actor and he does a like improv comedy. I'm like, that's much safer. But yeah, it was like, we were talking and he's a huge Star Wars fan too. So that kind of, we were talking about pro wrestling and Star Wars. And that led to I wonder what like pro wrestling would be like in the Star Wars universe. And that's how this book came to be, just the idea, just eating pie at a coffee shop.
Wow.
Yes.
Pro wrestling comic inspired by pie.
Yeah.
No, come that's
on. Just slice of pie.
The last slice. I was always curious about the title though, right? Why Rebel? Why semicolon Rebel?
That's one of those things where it's like, this is only issue one. Can't give away too much, but we're building into a storyline. Like what does that mean?
Okay.
And it becomes much clearer, I think, by the end of issue two, once people get that.
I kind of have an idea, not to give too much away, about some of the context that's kind of hidden in that first issue. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate enough to have a behind the scenes look, being one of the people that have helped procure your campaign and help it become successful as it is, as far as crowdfunding, and I was just kind of like, that's very ominous. I want to know more. Back.
That's what I like to hear. Yes. Yeah.
Well, also, there's kind of a selfish way. Titling it that leads it also, if it is successful and we end up... Because this storyline is like 6 issues. Once that wraps up, we can do Battle Grapple colon something else if we wanted to tell a different story about a different character in that same world. It's good branding because, Battle Grapple is the umbrella. And after the colon, we'll tell you kind of what it's about.
Well, yeah. Like any time, even like this, for stories like this, like Battle Grapple Rebel, if you follow the same ergonomics and the same storytelling tactics that wrestling uses, this could be a never-ending thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're just growing personas, and then those personas grow, and then those wants and needs grow too, just like some of the champions that come in and out of the babyface role. Like Chris Jericho is one of the most synonymous wrestlers out there, but he's more synonymously known for his back and forth of being the good guy and everybody's favorite bad guy.
Yeah.
Because his attitude is just so interchangeable. He knows how to work the psychology of the crowd to make people hate him. And he knows how to work the psychology of the crowd to make people love him for any one real reason. And he's like, time in wrestling history has kind of been convenient. I believe he still wrestles for AEW. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I always was fascinated by the level of psychological storytelling practice that went into a lot of these stories that you see on the television. Like, people think this is just, I mean, someone writes like a shoot script where it's like one page and this is what you're doing, this is what you're doing, everybody fills in the gaps. Like, WWE is fully scripted. When they cut promos, those have to be approved and practiced weeks, sometimes months prior to the event leading up to that show. And you don't just do it for that one show. You might do it one time for a recording, but you do for all the dark shows too. Like, not every show they do through every city in the United States is recorded for the live on-air stuff. You do what's called dark matches and stuff for all the other live events. So you're never going to have the same main event, you know, twice in one city. But you always have those same lines and those same feuds with people because it is scripted. And it's such in depth. But because all the psychological stuff that goes into it, it's really like live recording marketing.
Yep.
I mean, that's how much effort they put into it. I've always been fascinated by that as much as I'd hate to admit. But it's a level of storytelling genius that goes into it.
I think that's a weakness of modern WWE.
Oh, really?
Is having it be fully scripted. Because it's why there's no interesting, like, hyperbole aside, there's no interesting characters anymore. Like, you know, and the ones that break out are the ones who are doing kind of like unscripted. Something unscripted, something like unique that they had to fight, like, you know, quote unquote creative to get on the air. Like, and a lot of times they pay the price. Bray Wyatt, is the master of reinventing himself, and it all has come from him. They never presented him with a, like, you're going to go out there and say this and you're going to do this,
right,
and it not be crap. You know, like, him on the fly, him playing a character that he's working with and that he wrote the promo and he kind of developed, that's the key. And that's what the old school wrestling used to do. It's WWE is a corporation now. It's worried about its stockholders. It's corporate wrestling. They're that because the McMahons like money, which, okay, everyone likes money. But at the heyday of the business in the modern era, the Attitude Era, like, no one was approving Stone Cold's promos before he went out there. No one was approving Mick Foley's promos. Like, they went out there and they spoke from their character's heart. And again, that's like the unique part of pro wrestling, is there's this is something that directly plays into Battle Grapple, is you're playing a part, but you gotta believe it. There's gotta be part of you that believes what you're doing. So if you're playing like that dastardly heel, like, part of you has to, like, you have to get to that mental place where you are that dastardly heel. Like, it's the line is blurred between character and who you are. And that's why the best wrestlers, it's always some aspect of who they actually are as a person that helps get them over.
Right. No, I absolutely, I was going to say that too. Stone Cold Steve Austin, probably the most proficient denizen that pro wrestling's ever had, as far as breaking out into their own skin and not taking no for an answer. And, you know, that was kind of before, like, they'd already gone public, but they didn't really corporatize back then. It wasn't really as franchise as it was now, especially after the lawsuit they suffered from the World Wildlife Federation.
Yep.
That made them have to rebrand and kind of rethink of the way. I mean, that's when the John Cena was born, with the great slap, the first ever great slap, not the one that Will Smith had at the Oscars this past year, but when Kurt Angle smacked a young John Cena and was like, "Well, what makes you so special? Ruthless aggression." And then it went from the Attitude Era to the Aggression Era, where this like explosion of hot young talent came in and was taught a new bottom line and given a full script. But even like John Cena himself wasn't always fully scripted either. Mm-hmm. And of course, he left the company saying that he would be the last John Cena there ever was. And he was about as close to a Rock and a Hulk Hogan you could ever get as far as mainstream success.
Like, if you think, like, who in WWE right now could break out the same way that Cena or, you know, Dwayne the Rock Johnson, or even like Hulk Hogan break out, like, it was he, you know, not a great actor, and he wasn't in good stuff, but he still, like, he made movies, and he's still to this day probably one of the first wrestlers people think of. But like today's WWE, like who are they going to give that kind of power and chance to? Like, Randy Orton has longevity, but like, does anyone actually like him? This might be controversial. Randy Orton, not likable. He's literally negative charisma, in my opinion. Like, I just not interested in him. And you go like Bray Wyatt, they released him. Cody Rhodes desperately wants to be that, but is he ever going to break out? I mean, break out in a real way that's not just like having a reality TV show.
There's a lot of controversy surrounding him. So like he was tired of doing the Stardust motif and wanted to break out into his own character with his brother and stuff. And WWE said no, so he left. And then, you know, a year later, him and Tony Khan, they started up AEW. And then recently he left and he went back to the WWE as far as I'm like, as recently as I heard, making a debut at WrestleMania. And so, yeah, I mean, he portrayed that to go back, but I'm like, to go back to what, man? You were the Hulk Hogan, the Kevin Nash, and the Scott Hall of AEW, and you left?
Because this is like, not to get too much in the weeds of modern wrestling, but he was the flagship.
Yeah.
But the fans stopped liking him, and he wouldn't turn, or like I think at the very end he turned heel, but he lost the company. He had go away heat, not like heat. And when they got Daniel Bryan or Braniel Danielson, when they got CM Punk, like the writing's on the wall of what. Now I'm gonna say this, and it's gonna sound really offensive to anyone who like really loves like Cody Rhodes and AEW like core, but like what real stars look like. Like Young Bucks are fine. They're fine. Cody Rhodes is really talented, but he's fine. He cuts weird promos. But then you like put a Bryan Danielson match like with just about anybody next to like a Cody Rhodes match that's not against his brother. Like the Bryan Danielson match is gonna blow the Cody Rhodes match out of the water. It just is.
Yeah.
So I get like he was probably feeling like, well, shoot, I'm not top dog anymore. There are literally like they've brought in three other guys who are, you know, always going to be above me on the card now or in the fans' hearts. So like, why not get paid like by Vince for another go round? I am curious if because he was executive vice president. He was one of the executive vice presidents of AEW. Did he have to step down when he joined WWE? I would think there'd be like a non-compete clause, but
there's been a conspiracy that Tony Khan and Vince McMahon have been working together since the company started in the dark. I don't know how true that is.
I feel like it's in the same realm as Vince Russo went to WCW to destroy the company for Vince. Like it's people wanting to make the world more interesting than it actually is, rather than just be like, one guy had some good ideas with one company, and when he got too much power in the other company, his ideas sucked. There's no reason to overcomplicate it with conspiracy theories.
I mean, Eric Bischoff did say that Vince helped drive that company into the river. I can't say I agree, but I can't say that, you know, Eric Bischoff, you know, could have took the wheel and said, bad Vince. Yeah.
But then at one point he got fired too. Like the final days, the final year of WCW is wild. Like it is like, no one knows what's a shoot. No one knows what's a work. It's everything is something on a pole match. Bischoff thought like he was fired and he was going to try to buy the company from Turner Broadcasting when they wanted to sell it. And he thought like, it was in the bag when WWF offered more money and they bought it out from under him. It's like wild.
That's probably the greatest moment in wrestling memory for me was the night I turned on. I was watching. You could do this too. I was watching WCW, and then like the music came on after the last match, and then like you could switch over to, I forgot what WWF Raw was on. You could switch over and you could watch what was going on at the same time.
Yeah.
And I was just like, why is Shane McMahon in WCW? It was the greatest. It was the greatest. Like the invasion era is kind of what they call that first year, like 2001 when they were acquired. And then you had the WCW come over with, and in fact, ECW also closed at that point in time as well.
Right. Yeah.
They folded too. And that's when Paul Heyman came in with some of his ECW guys, and they kind of just turned it into like a, well, fuck it. If we're going down, we're going down in glory, and it's going to be, the tab's going to be on WWE.
Yeah.
So let's all go get paid one last time.
I was there the night of, I think it was on SmackDown, where it was the official like kind of WCW within WWE debut, which was the match between Buff Bagwell and Booker T, was a terrible match. It's one of those things where it's like, watching it live, there was just kind of this slow realization from the audience. I remember that we were all just like, because we were pumped, like Booker T was still over and Buff Bagwell was normally at least decent, but like that match just was not coming together. And like in the crowd, like we didn't have great seats, so it was one of those things where like mostly watching it on like the big screen above the ring, but we're like, what's something's not clicking. And then like got home that night and looking at all like the wrestling message boards, and they were all just like, that match sucked. Like, yeah, it did. Like, as much as we wanted to like it, it just was not a good match. And that kind of, and that was the thing is like none of the big WCW guys wanted to come over because they could just sit out their Time Warner contracts.
Right.
Except for like, you know, Booker T, you know, and Buff Bagwell were willing to like come over and work, and they stunk up the joint. And Booker T would later on, like, you know, have a career resurgence in WWE and like be a champion and everything. And poor Buff Bagwell would become a male prostitute in Las Vegas.
Is that true? That is
100% true. There is a Showtime like reality series about male gigolos in Las Vegas.
Wow.
And there's an episode about like Buff going to work for the company and his first job. I think it's probably not the case anymore, but for years, like he apparently worked for that company because his profile and his information was on that gigolo website. So you could order some Buff Bagwell.
Nice. Wow. I wonder if a lot of people asked him to call it in the ring.
Oh, Bagwell. I had no idea. Did you discover this when you were researching content and stuff for Battle Grapple?
That I knew. I can't remember where I learned that, but I recently, like, because I mentioned Jim Cornette, like his podcast, he was talking about it just a couple, I think, years ago at this point. That was the last I really heard any Buff Bagwell updates.
I remember he had a promo with The Undertaker during that feud he had with DDP and his wife Sarah, and there was like something happened. He was either during it or after it, and Buff Bagwell had made a statement, and they ended up firing him. And Undertaker was kind of the reason why he got fired. I don't know how true that is, because you know, locker room drama is all the buzz when it comes to wrestling news. Mm-hmm. So you never know what to believe. But I do believe, especially now that, you know, Undertaker is just one of the assets that WWE just won't let die.
Yeah.
I believe that might have some truth to it. A lot of people say that if it wasn't for Mark, John Cena wouldn't be as big as he is today. So he had that big match with it's been so long. Bradshaw, Layfield, John Bradshaw. Yeah. Mayfield, God, I almost forgot his name. It's been so long since I've seen him wrestle. That horrible, like, or it wasn't horrible, but it was bloody. It was like John Cena's bloodiest match. he earned his respect, and then he ended up facing The Undertaker not long after that. And, you know, back then when you faced The Undertaker, it was kind of like, it's hard to work with somebody that tall. It's hard to up. It's hard to throw him around. It's hard to even make his moves look good, especially when you're like Rey Mysterio's size, right?
Yeah.
I mean, his style of wrestling, they practiced that a lot, and he'd spent all his life in like wrestling American wrestlers who were taller than him, so he was used to it. But he was like the measuring stick that everybody looked up to. It was like, oh, we got to watch this match. We're gonna see if Mark puts another one in the ground or not. Like, we're talking about careers here, not just like, you know. So it's amazing what kind of rumors you could find out about like what used to happen, like the whole Matt Hardy Edge thing. That was actually a real life dispute.
Yeah. That's some messed up stuff.
Yeah, it's got deep cuts too. But man, I can't believe they milked it the way they did on television, man. Like you want to talk about like violence never solves issues. That storyline was definitely one that never solved issues. And even years later, after it had already occurred, like I'm sure there's still sore blood there.
Yeah.
That was like, betrayal on a level that I don't even know how Matt Hardy's still around. It's wild.
Yeah, and Matt Hardy really, like, that might have been like the thing that really pushed him to kind of go beyond, right? Like,
yeah,
like getting fired, getting brought back, like, and then him just being like, I'm gonna constantly revitalize my career, like revitalize my character, doing like whatever needs to happen.
Yeah.
And because he was always like he was always, you know, always seen as the less talented Hardy brother, but as we know, like, he also was the one that had fewer problems.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they both seem to like kind of gotten their stuff together and and have had like crazy long careers for two guys who like really set the horrible precedent of wrestlers putting their bodies on the line.
Oh yeah. Jeff was only 16 when he debuted on WWE, and he lied to them. Like, Matt Hardy and Jeff, I think it's about 2 years apart. If you watch their documentary that WWE released on home video, the DVD, Hardy Boys, they talk about that, how he was only 16. Like, they were really entrepreneurs from like the time their mom died when they were young all the way up until like forever. I mean, they haven't stopped. I mean, Matt Hardy's reinvented himself. It was kind of sad to see him come back after he had left the company for so long and couldn't use that character that he created.
Yeah, Broken Matt Hardy, yeah.
Yeah, because of the rights and stuff. But then he got the rights back, and then the WWE didn't like it, and so he went to AEW. Yep. And he probably learned the hard way, like, having arm candy just isn't enough. Or being a Hardy Boy just isn't enough. You constantly have to reinvent yourself. Unless you're Jeff Hardy and you like to jump off crazy high shit, then you're just known as Jeff Hardy for as long as your career goes and as long as you can jump off really high shit.
Yeah, like the most Jeff has ever done to revitalize himself is start wearing face paint.
Yeah.
It's weird. I'll never get used to it, but I understood at this point he's been wearing face paint longer than he hasn't been wearing face paint in the ring. Like, all right, I guess that's your gimmick now.
Well, I mean, he's getting so old, man. The stuff he does, putting his body on the line as being like a high flyer, I mean, he's got to be catching up to him.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I used to jump off 2-story buildings when I was 8, okay? I don't have the fucking joints I had. You know, back when I was a kid, my cartilage was tough and wasn't so tender. Now I'd be lucky to get out of bed without spraining an ankle, and I work out 3-4 times a week. So, I mean, it gets rough when you get older. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Like I guess like you could build like some kind of like cartilage or callus or something, you know, throughout your body that isn't like, you know, like a normal like a musician's callus. But I mean, that only takes you so far. I mean, look. If you, I don't know if you guys watched, but like the Undertaker's match with like Goldberg at that weird
one in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, like that. That was like a super huge childhood match that I used to like play with my action figures back when I had toys. know, like that was like a dream match. And then I watched it in real life. I was like, God, that was hard. That was hard to watch.
It's and I get like they had Undertaker's old, Goldberg's old, but it's painful to say that we've seen Goldberg do better after that match. Yeah. So it wasn't Goldberg who was the problem with that match. But I also get like it was probably very weird, and they probably were like, who knows how early they flew in? I don't know, like jet lag, like just the basic stuff of like doing a big show in a foreign country, like when they both hadn't worked for a while. Yeah, like I can see it was never going to be good, but that wasn't the point, right? The point was for a Saudi prince to have his dream match happen and pay Vince millions of dollars to do it, so Vince could pay Bill and Mean Mark Callis like whatever they ended up getting paid. I'm sure they probably each made $1 million, right? I feel like I heard like it was a ridiculous payoff for both of them.
Yeah.
The controversial one from seven, 8 years ago.
I feel it. Well, no, this was like 2 years ago.
2 or 3 years ago. There was controversy about taking off and going, and the company said that they would be there for a certain extended period. It was supposed to be short term, and they end up getting grounded, and some of them had to stay longer. Yeah. So they were kind of forced to stay. They couldn't leave. A lot of them had problems with that.
I really did think that would be an amazing premise for a WWE movie. Would be like a plane gets like they do a show in a foreign country. Vince and family make it out on their private plane, where the rest of the wrestlers are stuck there and become like prisoners. and so like John Cena, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and like all like the, you know, the big stars with action hero backgrounds, they have to like kind of do an Expendables thing and go to that country and rescue the other wrestlers.
Yeah. Or free themselves from whatever trappings they're held in.
Yeah.
They were forced to perform for the prince for the rest of their lives.
Like you kind of see, like they would do that plot with like North Korea, where they would do it with a basketball team. Like I could see that being how Hollywood actually makes that movie. Because you had like Dennis Rodman go to North Korea and hang out and play basketball with
Kim Jong-un,
the dictators. Yeah.
don't say the name. We don't want to get iced.
Yeah.
God, I remember when the interview came out. That was such a big thing. And coup de grace to the creators for putting it out anyway. That was a funny movie.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Switching gears, it's very rare that I have an artist on the show. Don, what was it like to kind of capture the choreographed artesian skill of professional wrestling on the static, non-moving imagery page we call comics?
You know, I feel like it was one of those things where, like I said, I spent a lot of time doing deep dives. And I flipped through, you know, like the WWE comics, and I hadn't really found any particular like style of paneling or shots that I really liked in those.
Right.
And so I was like, well, I feel like we got to kind of make it up as we go along, but also pay homage to that idea of kayfabe and, you know, calling it in the ring. And what Michael wrote, just put on the page, is just like really just colored the entire thing. And you know, I spent a lot of time going through the moves, just like you guys said, you know, like each move, it has a certain thing that you have to do to make sure that the move is safe between the two wrestlers, and that they're practicing it correctly and that they're executing it to perfection. And I hope that I spent time doing that, and that people get to see a little bit of how that goes in the ring. But yeah, it was, you know, you basically are just watching videos. If Michael's written down a particular move, and then you go in, look, research the move, and then just try to, in your mind, rotate the camera to where you need it to be so that you can see how it goes.
Yeah, I think the one I very specifically described, or like said, I just gave the move name. It was like, did I even do you the kindness of sending you a link to an example, or did I just be like, Google it?
You put the move in, and then I would just like Google it.
The corkscrew,
the corkscrew.
Yeah, the I forget like the Ultimo Dragon version of the leg corkscrew, which I'm blanking on what the proper name of that move is. But I was like, I want this character to do this move to this guy, and Don did a fabulous job of like conveying like the movement of the wrestling. It's so good.
Yeah, Ultimo Dragon's corkscrew moonsault, I think it was just called the Dragon Salt.
Now this is his his leg takedown where he like grabs a leg and he spins himself around, which causes his opponent to spin and like flip.
Oh Jesus!
Is it the Dragon?
I think his version of it was called the Dragon Screw. It's called something else. God, man, it's because it's like a cross between Mexican and Japanese. Mm-hmm. Oh man, that's gonna bug me, especially with all
the, it's that move.
Yeah. Games I've played of the years, creating characters, and like that was one of the moves that I always selected because it's just so fly. You can pull it out of nowhere and catch a leg and just corkscrew it, and they turn around.
Dragon leg screw. Just looked it up.
Dragon leg screw. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. Is like, you know, you have to watch the videos and understand the motion of that movement and like where the momentum and the weight goes, and then how the players in that situation, how the wrestlers have to protect one another in that move and sell it. Because, you know, ultimately we watch the flow of a match. Like, how you sell it is so important. Like you guys are talking about and have been talking about, is like when you go and see it live, also when you like watch it on TV, especially, you know, for me growing up as a kid, I believed in Santa, not ashamed to say. And you get to a certain age where you're just like, wrestling is real because I'm watching these two guys just pound on each other. And that's the thing that I think really pulls the audience in. We understand that it's a gladiatorial type of sports entertainment. And, you know, it's important to get that audience to sway with you. And you know, try to bring them on your side or try to make them hate you, but at the same time, you know, invested into that athleticism that John is like being able to make sure that it looks real. And you know, that was one of those things, is like we want to make sure that we did that justice, and I hope I executed that properly.
That's, and you did.
Yeah, you did, man. Like looking at some of the artwork and stuff, like the campaign, I'm like, there's some really authentic genuinism in these choreographed moves, the way the art moves and the fluidity moves. It's kind of like, yeah, this is awesome. And the arrangement too. I'm sorry to be so cryptic to the audience, but you know, we can't display a whole lot. You'll just have to go
to battlegrapplerebel.com and you can see for yourself some of the fantastic artwork.
Plugged it. You went for it. I was going to do it too.
We'll do it a few more times.
Tag in now. There's still some fantastic tiers too. We unfortunately had a person whose circumstances changed. We had this tier where you could get your own custom action figure of yourself, Kid Bash by Dave Wheeler or Michael Tanner. And unfortunately, the person's circumstances changed. So that one spot has opened back up again. So you can still do that. And we are also doing a special thing where we're drawing backers. At I think it's $150 tier where we're drawing the backers into the audience of the comic. So if you look at the cover that's on display right now, that's mine, you'll notice that it's actually just in flat stages. I haven't rendered anything aside from just flatting out the page. And then there's a ton of white space, and we're looking to draw five lucky backers into that. And if anybody needs to know what my work looks like in terms of doing likenesses, just hop on to my webpage at winningit.com and you'll get to see some likenesses there.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Winning it.
Yeah.
What a marketable last name you have.
I do. It's funny because early on, I'm not sure if you know Dustin Nguyen. A lot of people do, but he followed me. And I think part of the reason he started following me just because he was super amused by my username, and he's like, why didn't I come up with that first? I think you do it.
That's awesome, man. Like and Michael, when you were writing this, one of the biggest things about pro wrestling is making interesting characters. What were kind of some of the inspirations that you looked towards for some of the main characters in the story?
That is an excellent question. And in my original like pitch document that I created for the book, when I did a character breakdowns, I put little pictures of what actual pro wrestler was kind of an inspiration behind it. So our main character is Spin Kilter is his name, and he's your typical kind of like young, naive guy who just wants to be a wrestler. Like that's all he wants to do. And so like pulling from the tropes of like everyone who's kind of had a dream, you know? And so like wrestler wise, I'm trying to remember who I put down as his inspiration. I'm trying to like get to the document and see if I can find it real quick. But so like Spin is our main character. He's just like, he's like your sweet kind of naive kid who we're going to follow on his hero's journey in a way in the world of future pro wrestling. And every good hero has to, every good baby face has to have like a dastardly heel. And so his main antagonist is a fellow, you know, young wrestler, a young grappler named Stellar Debris. And Stellar is that kind of Shawn Michaels, like 90s Shawn Michaels, kind of like cocky, narcissistic heel, who just, you know, contrasts very, very well with like a kid who's like genuine and I guess more kind of like a Bret Hart guy. He's not super flashy. He's not electrifying. He's just a good worker. And how does just like a good worker compete against someone who is charismatic, dynamic, thrill-o-matic, like Stellar Debris? So kind of going with like those are our two mains, and then fleshing out the rest of the Battle Grapple world. So we have their coach slash trainer who Don took a lot of inspiration from, Captain Lou Albano. And although he doesn't even watch the show, there's a lot of Carl from Aqua Teen Hunger Force in Coach Muna, who's just like that guy who probably is a fairly decent trainer, but he's also the kind of guy who's going to charge you for everything. Like you are paying him. And it's one of those things where there's a reference in the first issue where like Spin, you know, gets like an indie gig, and you know, whatever little money he's going to get paid, half of that is going to Muna until he like works off his training debt, you know, which is very kind of old school pro wrestling in a way. He's, and inspiration wise, he's a lot of kind of Fabulous Moolah. So that kind of exploitation of the people she trained, like that aspect of the character, like comes through. Coach Muna, Fabulous Moolah, it's there. I changed one letter in the name. And then there's, you know, there's a character who's very much influenced by like Paul Heyman and Jim Cornette, who's like, you know, he's a talent scout for the Battle Grapple TV show, or, you know, Galactic show. There's like fun characters, because we're very much in like the Mud Show region of Battle Grapple, so we don't get to see a lot of the like the more elaborate and fabulous characters yet. We got to grow to that as Spin moves into a wider grappler world. But you know, there's like a big guy named Big Sky, and then I can't remember if there's any references to some of the other ones, but like coming up, there's wrestlers. Like there's the alien wrestler, you know, he's got four arms. How much of a like an advantage is that? There's a guy who there's like a like an old veteran who I based mostly on Hacksaw Jim Duggan, whose name is Strongman Halloran. He's, you know, he's not very talented, but he's been around for decades and everyone loves him. He's a character people will meet in issue two. So it's like I did a lot of like mix and matches. There's a character who is very much going to be like if the Undertaker and the Ultimate Warrior had a baby. This character is you're going to be introduced to, who has one of my favorite names. His name is the Inevitable. It's a long name because it's meant to be like too much to say. His name is the Inevitable Fate of the Dying.
Oh wow.
And so people just call him IFD for short.
Ultimate Warrior's intensity meets the undying
character. I can't, if you've seen the Kickstarter, we did some promos from some of the characters. to like get people to back the Kickstarter. So I voiced one character and some voiceover friends voiced the other characters.
Yeah.
For book two, the promos for that one are going to be insane because there will be one from The Inevitable Fate of the Dying, which will just be like a long rambling Undertaker / Ultimate Warrior promo, which I think is just going to, I think I might just write it to be like 5 minutes long and see how long, and I'll just watch the YouTube analytics to see how long people get before they just click off of it. Cause they're like, this is too weird. This is way too weird.
Out of like 136. Yeah.
I'm gonna tap out.
It'd be like Batman at the end of the movie, the new one where he puts that adrenaline.
I haven't seen it. No spoilers.
Oh,
no. All
right. It's not really a spoiler.
I can't wait to see Robat Bat-and-Bat be Batman.
Oh, God. No comment. We could talk after you watch it. It's free on HBO Max now. They get a free plug for me. That's all I get. But the intensity of Ultimate Warrior meets the undying character of the Undertaker. That sounds like someone who's really excited for everybody to go to hell. That's awesome. A fun idea. I was thinking about this while you guys were talking about the characters and stuff. For like a sneak peek at issue two, you could present like a Pokédex only with wrestlers of some of the guys at the end of the book. You know, like look out for these guys somewhere.
You know, we're doing trading cards for this Kickstarter. Not to like too much behind the scenes. We're still working out what those trading cards are actually going to be. I kind of hope we're able to preview some characters like Boba Fett style, where like you're going to meet this character in issue two. Oh, enjoy this trading card for a year until you have that.
Yes. Episode. He never shows up.
Oh yeah, we're going to promise later that he has like a rocket firing backpack. Yeah. And then he does not use it.
No.
He never uses it. There's no reference to it in the book.
Where does this pitchfork go?
Last year fan fiction for this card here at the link below in the QR code. Just scan it.
First sign this waiver.
That's right. It's just a thought. I've seen a lot of indie books come and go. And some of the cooler ones always had that, like, they had those classic, I mean, this is even before I can't remember his name now. The Jack Ryder books, way back in the day, they used to have, like outlines, like character outlines of who's going to be in the book before you read the story.
Oh, okay.
And I found that so fascinating because, like, isn't that the whole point of reading the story is to find a book? And, like, they break down the character. They even gave you the title name. I have to send you a snapshot of one of the books. Like, I got this off a cart at a library because I do that randomly sometimes just to switch it up to see how, like, what I'm missing or what I've missed or if I've missed anything at all in my own, like, reading. Like, it's good education and it's free. And this is in the front of the book. It's just like an entire character glossary. It had like who it was, what they do, and possibly where you'll find them in the story. I was like, that's an interesting approach. Yeah. What if someone picked that up and read the glossary and was like, I don't know if I want to read this anymore. And I was like, why didn't they just put that in the back of the book? And then some comics have like this kind of like Pokédex type layout in the back with all their characters and like the layouts of like power stats and what they can do and kind of like a little origin story.
Yeah, Marvel does that a lot with the team books now, where it's like it's an X-Men book where literally there's 100 different characters who might show up in this issue. So it's like here's the 8 characters that are in this book that you maybe have never read anything with them in. So here's 2 lines to describe who they are and a line to describe what they can do. There you go. You're caught up.
Well, in their defense, they just do that because they don't have time to showcase the smaller people because, they're too busy with all their crossovers. It's been so long. I just bought into the X-Men sword stuff. I bought a graphic novel just because I didn't want to buy issue by issue. And I'm I'm still hesitant about reading it because of how huge it is and how they like restarted the X-Men universe again after the swords and the blue. And then like, I was just like,
yeah, it's X-Men books are wild. Like I get like, they're too much for me at this point. And I can't read Jonathan Hickman. Like I can acknowledge that he is a good writer. He's just not a writer I enjoy reading. So it's like when I was like, oh, Hickman is taking over the X-Men books. I'm like, I'm not going to buy an X-Men.
And they do so much stuff now with all the crossover.
At this point, because I'm not going to understand anything that goes on. It's going to be all like, big brain theory stuff, which is Hickman's like bread and butter.
And that's what we got. We got, you know, Krakatoa, and we got gold eggs that are rebirth, and X-Men never actually die. They just get reborn. And Moira McTaggart is a mutant who lives different lives in different continuity. I'm just like, yeah, that's just like, turn that down. And I can get on board. But I get some people like it. It's just not for me.
Yeah, I recently discovered Spawn, and I kind of congratulate Todd McFarlane for going so long with his series, not breaking up and having huge events and doing as many spinoffs as most people would like. And even his spinoff is still about the original character.
And that's hilarious to me because his big thing in the 90s was that there was a definitive end for Spawn. That's why he had the power meter. And he knew, like, he's like, I'm not going to be doing Spawn comics forever. I'm like, dude. That's
true, yeah.
You liar.
Well, you know, in more recent interviews, because I've been like diving into this, because I've been fascinated with the history outside of Marvel that I never knew about, and like independents have been around for a long time. And did you know that Marvel had their own imprint called Iconic for all of their big writers that they didn't want leaving the company? I didn't either. But in some of his most recent interviews, he was like, I have an idea of how I want to end Spawn, but I hope I never have to write it. So I guess his retirement plan is, so long as people keep buying Spawn, he will figure out ways to write it. which I don't know. I mean, the art is, so long as it looks as cool as it does, and it still hinges on the on that topic of like death and hell and demons and stuff, which there's always a market for. That's why Supernatural was so infamous for so long, right?
Yeah,
I don't even know if Spawn is Todd's bread and butter at this point. I feel like McFarlane Toys is like,
I think he probably like makes way more money. He seems to often like talk more about like the toys. But it could just be like what realms I'm looking at. But also like contrast like McFarlane and Spawn with like Larson and Savage Dragon. Like it's no knock to either dude. But like McFarlane seems to be more of a businessman who does comics. And Larson is a guy who does comics. Like Savage Dragons is just he kept it. Like, okay, sure there's some Savage Dragon toys and there's a Savage Dragon cartoon, because like, why not? But like, he's never stopped drawing Savage Dragon. Like, he has kept up that book since the beginning. Like, maybe with a few short hiatuses, maybe with a few fill-ins, but for the most part, that's like the one Image property that is still current, that is still primarily done by the original creator. And that is amazing. And I never gave Larson credit when I was a kid. Like, he was always the other Spider-Man artist. But man, like, he is like a true, a little flowery here, but he's a true artiste. And I did not honestly appreciate him until I saw some original pencils from Savage Dragon at the Comic Book Art Museum in San Diego.
Oh, wow.
His pencils are amazing. Like,
yeah,
it blew my mind and made me just be like, I'd like jaw dropped. Like, I was like, this is what Larson's stuff looks like just pure, like untouched. This is amazing. And that just made me like turn around on him. Like, I dismissed Eric Larson like largely as a creator who I just was not interested until I saw those pencils. And then I'm just like, I don't necessarily want to read stuff that he does. Like, Savage Dragon did not interest me, but like him as a creator like started to really fascinate me. And I think he's amazing.
Oh, you know what? fun story about Eric Larson is when I was a kid, I wrote and sent drawings to a bunch of creators. And he's one of the two, actually three creators, I think, that returned my letter and autographed a trading card that I sent to him. So shout out to Eric Larson.
Shout out to Eric Larson, man. That's awesome.
I wasn't a huge Eric Larson fan in terms of his Spider-Man, but the thing that I loved him for was I loved his Venom. I loved his Venom more than Todd McFarlane's Venom. Yeah. I just thought it was so crazy. So how I draw Venom now is totally like inspired in part by how he does it or how he did it back in the day. But yeah, I mean, the guy is a machine. Like, he just does some crazy stuff. And he's a huge Jack Kirby fan. I don't know if you guys know that part about him, but he owns a lot of original Jack Kirby pages. Like maybe 7, 8, maybe even 10 years ago, there was a show of Jack Kirby art out in Cal State LA Northridge. And most of those pages were his.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he invested well.
He's retiring good someday.
Yeah.
Ever lets go of them, because I mean, did you guys read about that comic that sold for like $2.4 million at auction?
Yeah. What issue was that? I remember the article, but I don't remember what comic it was.
Oh man, I can't even pull it up right now. I thought it was ridiculous. Like you could only hope to ever reach a level of like glory in comics. And this is like most of the creators who worked on it are either dead or working on things that don't matter anymore. Very seldom of them are ever working on anything else. But before we get too off topic, Eric said something on Facebook today about Savage Dragons. Since you guys brought that up, it was kind of beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it was about someone asking him about, you know, why haven't they made like a Savage Dragon movie and stuff. And he said, most people's dream is for people to see their stuff on, you know, like on television screens and on video games. And he said, my only dream was Savage Dragon become a comic book. And I was just like, wow.
True artiste, man, right there. Like that, he was in it to do what he did, and he's still doing it.
Yeah, he wasn't even humble. It's like, you can't even call it humble. It's just like what he genuinely wanted for his idea. And like, how often do you see creators actually stick to those types of guns when in the eyes of millions of dollars that could be made?
Again, like contrast it with like McFarlane, who I guarantee you he would never give that answer.
probably not.
Like Todd has kept talking about that Spawn movie that's never going to get made for the last like 15 years. Like, he clearly wants there to be another Spawn movie, and he keeps talking about it as if it's going to happen. But is it going to happen? Feel like Eric would have just moved on by now about the Savage Dragon movie.
Well, yeah, it's like cool. It happens. It doesn't. Whatever.
Yeah. And part of that comment he made on Facebook was you could spend your whole life for the next 2 years knocking on doors and making telephone calls trying to sell something to somebody that already exists in its own light. And I was just like, wow, he's right. Like, this, it like totally killed any inhibition of me wanting to still be a screenwriter. I'm like, yeah, why waste the time when I could just make a comic book? You're right, Eric. Let's go.
And you know, that's not to like knock anybody that's trying to do that. Obviously, I've also worked with screenwriters, and you know, it's a numbers game. It's like you try to put out as much work as possible. And for me, my joy comes from drawing comics. Yeah. And I don't want to speak for Michael, but I feel like, you know, we're out there because we love the medium so much. Mm-hmm. And if a screenwriter wants to make a comic and I can help do that, I'm gonna do it because I just want to draw comics. Right. I think, you know, Eric Larson talking about that is right. And just to throw it in, I looked it up. It was a Mike Zeck page. It's page 25 from Secret Wars 8, which we all know is one of the first appearances of the black suit of Spider-Man. That's
right.
And it opened up at 330K, and then it went into a bidding war and ended at 3.4 mil.
Oh, my goodness. That's so crazy. It's amazing.
But we all know, you know, that Secret Wars 8 book is a major key. So,
mm-hmm. And speaking of key books, like I'm waiting to see what I can get for my copy, my first appearance of Miss America Chavez, once Doctor Strange into the Multiverse of Madness comes out, because I'm like, I've got her first appearance.
Absolutely. Ooh,
that's like a $400 or $500 book, right? Because it's a Young Avengers, so it's a bunch of appearances of
other- No, it's a book called Vengeance. It's a limited series. Okay. That literally, and there was some controversy with the writer, like being like, I didn't get compensated for creating Miss America Chavez.
Yeah, I saw
which
that.
I can speak a lot about that, which will probably get me in trouble. But that series is interesting because Marvel did it because they had commissioned six covers from an artist, like a painting, like painted covers. They didn't know what they wanted to use them for. That six covers, like showing six iconic Marvel villains. And they're like, we don't have a book. We don't have why did we do this? And so like they went to the writer and they're like, write a series, a limited series that we can use these covers for. So the premise is it's about a new young super team called the Young Allies, who are mysterious, and they're all like new characters. And it's very much like a 40-year-old trying to write hip cool teens, like edgy teens. And they kind of like, and She-Hulk gets involved, and it kind of involved, they kind of have to interact with each of these iconic villains in the story, where they're trying to protect the new incarnation of the In-Betweener, which is a cosmic entity. And the In-Betweener is the new incarnation is like an emo teen. And the thing that gets me is the Miss America Chavez that appears in Vengeance is nothing like what the character eventually became. So it's a Joe Kelly, I think, is the writer. Joe Kelly saying he created Miss America Chavez is technically true, but also technically not true, because that should go to Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey on Young Avengers, that actually created the version of Miss America Chavez that we see today in the Marvel Universe and in the movie Doctor Strange Multiverse of Madness. Like,
I think I got a glimpse of her in the trailer. She was supposed to be in the Spider-Man movie, but they cut her out of it because of time constraints, and they moved her into what they were already going to have in the movie anyway.
Yeah,
was Doctor
that,
Strange
that blue jean jacket with the white star? Like that is like, and the characterization just is pure Gillen and McKelvey. So that's my controversial take on. Joe Kelly saying he deserves more credit for that character being in Doctor Strange. And it's controversial, I know, and people hate that, but yeah, there we go.
That's your opinion, man. It's fine.
My opinion.
The long opinion is that, and I can say this because, you know, I haven't published mainstream yet, right? So there's a long list of creators who haven't been given their dues for all the millions and billions that a lot of these corporations have enjoyed, and pensions that have filled the pockets of people who don't know what it is to be a goddamn creator. So if there was just a little bit more respect and honesty in the industry, mainstream side of things, there'd be a lot more happier artists and creators out there. And hopefully one day I won't fall into that pocket.
You know, that's kind of the important reason why, you know, people should support indie comics and be on Kickstarter, and why we appreciate it when people come and do that for, you know, like Battle Grapple Rebel. And, you know, I feel like, you know, Michael, you've been lucky enough. I've been lucky enough where our careers, and we meet amazing fans that have also just become friends throughout the years, that just, you know, come to back our play, come to see what's next and what's new. So, yeah, every time, if you're listening out there, and you're like, I only follow like the big four publishers or the big two publishers. Give indie comics a chance, because indie comics ultimately are the incubator for brand new ideas. If you look back at the history of comics, you're talking about, you know, characters that are created, people that are coming through the ranks. A lot of those people are indie creators, you know, like Brian Michael Bendis and David Mack. Like, I had a wonderful conversation with David Mack about how he started out and like coming up through Caliber Press. And now it's funny because when they were younger and they started out, you know, Brian Michael Bendis was the artist and David Mack was the writer. And now they've completely switched places. Most people, like, I knew David Mack. I know David Mack as a painter, and I know Brian Michael Bendis as an amazing writer. And, you know, these are the things, but everybody paid their dues and came up through indie comics. And yeah, you're going to find, if you're tired of the constant reboots of crossovers that sometimes don't make any sense, then just come and check out, you know, some of the punctuated storytelling, some of the amazing short stories that are in these crazy anthologies that people are putting out. They're just fantastic. There's just such rich storytelling and new ideas that are just coming out of indie comics. And I think the fact that Kickstarter has been one of the biggest publishers of comics, if not the biggest publisher of comics in like the last 6 years, says a lot to that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially with all the TV shows and stuff optioning up comic book property, because I don't know if people are starting to like wind down on the novel side of things, but novelists are becoming screenwriters. Screenwriters are becoming comic writers. Comic writers are becoming screenwriters. Everything's interchangeable now. But a majority of the industry pulls all of its original content from comic books because it's so visual, mm-hmm. and it's such an artistic way to convey a story with
ready-made storyboards.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've seen that like immediately just recently with that shot from the Love and Thunder trailer, which is taken directly from one of the comics.
Oh yeah. Huge shout out. I can't wait for that one. That's going to be awesome.
And yeah, there's movies that you don't even realize are rooted in comic books. Like what's that Jennifer Lopez movie that just came out like a little while back? Marry Me, right? Was that what it's called?
Oh, really?
Yeah, that started out as an indie comic. Like, so the person who picked it up for production.
Oh, that's amazing.
That was an indie comic. I think was Road to Perdition also a graphic novel?
Yep, Road to Perdition was a graphic novel.
Road to Perdition is another one. So there are a lot of properties that people don't realize. And there's, you know, even amazing things that were indie comics that are people like, oh, like Hellboy, The Crow, Tank Girl. These are like, to me, they're super underappreciated properties in terms of like, the discussion of movies, because everybody's all about the MCU. But if you look back, like The Crow was such a groundbreaking genre setting piece of film. And then you look at the comic and it's amazing. Like what James O'Barr did with The Crow and like the idea, like the germ that he set with that story. And that
and how that movie, fantastic. Like the fact that The Crow got made into a movie at that time.
Yeah.
It's so amazing. Because we're way pre like Marvel Renaissance. We're pre like, you know, we're pre X-Men. We're pre Blade. Like the fact that a comic book movie, a superhero comic book movie, so stylized, got made mid '90s, is just an amazing story in and of itself.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, that's why I love indie comics. I cannot like soapbox about it enough. If you come to my table, I'm sure same with you, Michael, if you come over to your table, mm-hmm. you know, like I feel like a lot of us in the indie scene, we love talking about things like this. And, you know, we don't even necessarily care about just having something made as a movie or as a cartoon or maybe like that is a fantastic benefit. If that comes to be, then that's great. But it's also just like that being able to get your stories out, to get art out and like find people that are excited about it. That's the rush, man. Like I love it when people come to my table and they're like, are you doing commissions? Like what is Pablo the Gorilla? Like what is this crazy Nightmare Theater book that is so huge on your table? So stuff like that, like that invigorates me. And when I show up to a show and people are, I meet actual comic book fans that are interested, not just people are like passing by because they're looking for like the next print of, you know, like whatever MCU character. Like mm-hmm. the people that stop and talk to you and like want to read the comics, that's, you know, that's the community. And that's what we hope to foster with a project like Battle Grapple Rebel. And I think, you know, Battle Grapple Rebel, the thing that I love about what Michael's done is it's not just about wrestling. It's that everyman story. You know, a lot of us have this in our backgrounds where we're trying to work and we're trying to accomplish something. And that's that classic spin character. You know, you're putting in the sweat. And you're hoping to get that sweat equity. And then, you know, classically and diametrically opposed to you is this other character that just seems to have it all together, you know? And Michael, like in terms of what he's written in that first issue, it's just a glimpse, but it's like, he's done it so well. Like I can't even talk about how well he's executed it. Cause it really, you know, it alludes to a greater story. And I think it really is a comic that even a casual fan will just enjoy because it has such like common thematics and archetypes in it.
I'm excited for it because Okay, so I don't know if you guys watched the first season of a show called Heels.
No, I haven't seen
it. I've heard about it, but I have not watched it yet.
Okay, so for everybody at home and doesn't know what this show is, Heels is a show on Stars that came out over the past year. It stars Stephen Hamel. I don't know the actor's name, but he played Ragnar's son in Vikings. And it's about a couple of brothers in the life of a family who's been in control of this wrestling promotion for a long time. And it's about wrestling, but what surprises me the most is how emotional and dramatic outside the wrestling ring it goes. So it's not more about wrestling than it is about how wrestling affects the lives of those around them. And so I got to see some of that in Battle Grapple, and I won't allude to it, but there's a lot of dynamics that become the conflict that kind of up the stake for Spin to succeed. And so he's caught between those types of conflicts and making friends, and also like having this huge dream that everybody that he works with all wants, and finding that way to get an opportunity to become part of, you know, that thing that he wants to do, and that greater promotion from where he is right now. Cause there's always right now, he's not even at like the Florida Championship Wrestling stage. He's at that sweaty, smelly, cigarette roach invested like gym down the street that you pay $8.
He's at the VFW hall.
Yeah. Been to some of those shows, man. That's how I got my start, and that's how I got my start with SWA. Was going to a few of those shows down the house. I walked down there and held at this old kind of like duplex slash training center for the National Guard over by my house park. And you got to meet people after the show. You can even pay $50 and you can get in the ring and you like show them what you do. They might book you for a match. Even as a jobber, right? Those people that those are people who take hits and make somebody look good, and they don't win. But I thought it's awesome to see that type of storytelling injected into something already so artistic, because you're showcasing two different types of lifestyles, being somebody else, and then that who that person is outside of that persona is a very fascinating contrast to character for me. So I'm looking forward to the longevity of this series myself.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
We really
do. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like pro wrestling was my first love. It was never about, it's never about writing to me. It was about, when I was younger, a little personal background. When I was younger, I had a really hard upbringing. I had a stepfather, abusive. We were legally kidnapped as kids.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, and like the system, it's got a few loopholes and it's got a few cracks. And me and my sister, we slipped in between them. And what kept me alive through a lot of that was pro wrestling, because I always looked up and was inspired by smaller guys like Rey Mysterio, who could stand up to people like, Kevin Nash and Scott Hall and the Big Show and The Undertaker and Kurt Angle, people who might have been stronger or faster. Also people like Kane, right? Yeah. Who made a Mississippi Coast Con this year, who just didn't care about who you were, regardless of how big you were, standing next to him, who could just knock you down to size. And there were a few times where he played the good guy, and he just like come after somebody for some noble reason. And that those kind of like set the morality compass for me and kind of put me in perspective on like my own personal growth and where I was in my life. So pro wrestling has been like a labor of like love and kind of like a therapy for me for a long time. Like, So not only is it passionate, to talk about, but it's also so refreshing to see storytelling being used, with pro wrestling in mediums like, film and television and even comic books. I recently backed, it was last year, I backed Tony Schiavone's.
Butts and Seats.
Yes.
Butts and Seats from Source Point with Jerk Manning.
Yeah.
Shout out to Dirk and Tatrita and that team.
I haven't read it yet, man, but I got the hardbook cover with the faceplate on it because I loved that era so much because it kept me going, man. Like, I honestly don't know if I'd really be here without professional wrestling today. So it was only right that I invest in that and kind of hold on to that memory, you know, so I could share that stuff with my kids. And even though it's not something that I would probably want them to do because I'm their father and, you know, I don't want nobody to get hurt. You know, I've seen injuries happen in the ring. just not long ago, I don't know if you guys know this, like Rey Mysterio almost didn't make it back to the WWE after a really botched match in Mexico. Somebody died.
I had heard something crazy happen, but I didn't really know what the details were.
So there was a video, I don't know if it's on the internet anymore, where he went in to do the 619, right?
Yeah.
And when he hit the rope, he just kind of collapsed and keeled over. Well, it turns out that, you know, he'd suffered from a broken neck. And he had passed away on the scene when paramedics show up. And it was really close for a minute there on like whose fault it was. And in wrestling, you put your trust in somebody so much that sometimes you either endanger yourself or you endanger the other person. And that's why a lot of the rules are the way they are when you're in a professional wrestling ring. And kayfabe is so important because you're not only performing for an audience, but you're also helping each other keep each other safe while doing all that stuff. And it's legitimately, psychologically, it's work because you have to put your mind in a space, in a physical space before it gets there. Yeah. And I mean, that's like, it's like ballet. You got to hit your marks. So you got to know. So it's really time testing. So I wouldn't want my kids to do something like that, but I wouldn't be against it if that's what they really wanted to do with the lives. But it's passionate enough for me. That's why I was super excited to have you guys on the show today to talk about.
Thank you for having us. No, it's always good to kind of like share the project and like share controversial opinions in a place where you can just like go wild.
Oh man, I love the open forum and talking with creators like this about, you know, what inspired you guys and how these ideas came up and just to help get exposure for the book. Cause I am very much a purveyor of supporting independent comics. And I wasn't aware of how much I supported independent comics until I stopped reading Marvel, DC. And I just kind of like shook my head out of the like stigmata of mass marketing and kind of realized like I was at a redo mall the other day. It's like this mall where people buy like little venues and they set up shop. It's like a bunch of stores and a bunch of in a store. And I found a whole series of Wildcats comics. I'm like, what are these?
Oh, yeah. Old Jim Lee series from back in the day from Image.
Yeah. They had like a crossover with Tomb Raider and Alien. And I swear to God, it's like somebody came in and dropped off an entire run of single issues from like one all the way to like, they had like a small mini series called The Trilogy. I bought that. And then I think about like one through 10. And then they had this really shiny elusive cover that I just couldn't keep my eye off of. It was like issue 50 or 38 or something. And it was holographic. And I was like, man, that looks really nice. But just the characters and stuff was like, I didn't know this stuff existed back then. And they look, you know, like any other, like not like Marvel comics would look, but they look in retrospect, you know, similarity to what you would find in mainstream. But I read a few issues and oh my God, the stories are, if not better than Marvel, some of the most recent Marvel stories that I've read, you know, in recent years. And I'm just kind of like discovering this whole world of like independent comics on top of all the things coming out of Kickstarter.
Oh man. There's a
whole stack.
Yeah, you can find some great stuff in like really weird places. I found out like an antique store in the middle of nowhere in Oregon. I found some signed copies of Boris the Bear number one, which is like old school Dark Horse Comics.
Wow.
It was a parody of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle parodies. it's really crazy. But I got to say, I gotta go because I am supposed to be on another podcast in 15 minutes and I got to eat dinner.
Yeah, that's probably good.
thank you guys so much for coming on the show and for your time. And I don't want to hold you up. So if you want to know where you can get Battle Grapple, you can go ahead and say the website.
Go to
battlegrapple.com.
Go to battlegrapple.com. That'll take you to the Kickstarter project page. We're running through May 9th. Like I think we mentioned, we are fully funded, but we got some sweet stretch goals and we got some backer goals that we want to hit before the close. We want to get to 100 backers so we can get this book in sweet, sweet color.
Awesome, man. Yeah. And you got to go support them, support Battle Grapple, go to a wrestling show on the cover of a wrestling comic. That's always fun. I'm your host, Inevitable Mike. This is Michael Tanner and Don Wynn with Battle Grapple Rebel. Thank you for listening. Come back and see us. And if you want to hear more, go to comicsandpop-tarts.com for all my greatest episodes and the episodes still to come. Thank you guys. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, no problem.